Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour. Coming up in a few moments, Joan Knows, EWTN's bureau chief here in Rome, Joan Lewis, brings us the Vatican Week in review. But first, we join Jill Bevilacqua for her weekly reflection on the Sunday Gospel, a programme by the title of There's More in the Sunday Gospel Than Meets the Eye, which begins with Sean Patrick Lovett reading the Gospel for the third Sunday in Advent.
The crowds asked John, "What ought we to do?" In reply, he said, "Let the man with two coats give to him who has none. The man who has food should do the same." Tax collectors also came to be baptized, and they said to him, "Teacher, what are we to do?" He answered them, "Exact nothing over and above your fixed amount." Soldiers likewise asked him, "What about us?" He told them, "Do not bully anyone. Denounce no one falsely. Be content with your pay." The people were full of anticipation, wondering in their hearts whether John might be the Messiah. John answered them all by saying, "I am baptizing you in water, but there is one to come who is mightier than I. I am not fit to loosen his sandal strap. He will baptize you in the Holy Spirit and in fire. His winnowing fan is in his hand to clear his threshing floor and gather the wheat into his granary, but the chaff he will burn in unquenchable fire." Using exhortations of this sort, he preached the good news to the people.
Whether we read Matthew, Mark, or Luke, there's no doubt that the preaching of John the Baptist attracted crowds. "All Judea and all the people of Jerusalem made their way to him," writes Mark. "Jerusalem and all Judea and the whole Jordan district," we read in Matthew. And though no one can be sure of the exact year when John began his mission, there are those who believe it may well have been in a sabbatical year, which would have accounted in some degree for the great concourse of people flocking to the prophet from the desert. Today, when an academic takes a sabbatical, it usually means a period of freedom from lecturing duties to allow time for study or research. But its origin was in Mosaic law and is described in detail in the books of Exodus, Leviticus, and Deuteronomy.
Yahweh spoke to Moses on Mount Sinai. He said, "Speak to the sons of Israel and say to them, when you enter the land that I am giving you, the land is to keep a Sabbath's rest for Yahweh. For 6 years you shall sow your field. For 6 years you shall prune your vine and gather its produce. But in the seventh year, the land is to have its rest, a Sabbath for Yahweh. You must not sow your field or prune your vine or harvest your ungathered corn or gather grapes from your untrimmed vine. It is to be a year of rest for the land. The Sabbath of the land will itself feed you and your servants, men and women, your hired laborer, your guest, and all who live with you. For your cattle too, and the animals and your land, all its produce will serve as food."
Thus Leviticus. But in the book of Exodus, after stating that the land must be allowed to lie fallow and you must forego all produce from it, we read, "Those of your people who are poor may take food from it, and let the wild animals feed on what they leave. You shall do the same with your vineyard and your olive grove." Deuteronomy is even more emphatic.
"Let there be no poor among you then. Is there a poor man among you, one of your brothers, in any town of yours in the land that Yahweh your God is giving you? Do not harden your heart or close your hand against that poor brother of yours, but be open-handed with him. when you give to him, you must give with an open heart. Of course, there will never cease to be poor in the land. I command you, therefore, always be open-handed with your brother and with anyone in your country who is in need and poor.
If that year was indeed a sabbatical year, surely John would have reminded the people of this and of their charitable duties. And indeed, when they asked him what they should do, the first thing Luke mentions is just that, to give to him who has not. The reference to two coats, or two tunics, as another version has it, reminds me of Carlo Carretto's story of what happened to him when he first went to the desert, as a little brother of Charles de Foucault, to learn to pray. The sun is high in the sky, the temperature is like hell fire, and the water is boiling in the radiator of his jeep. He decides to stop near a great rock of granite and pitch camp in its shade. He spreads out his mat and sits to recite a few psalms, then stretches out on the sand to sleep. In the desert, he explains, you take your siesta before your meal.
In order to lie more comfortably, I looked for a blanket to put under my head. I had two. One remained by my side unused, and as I looked at it, I could not feel at ease. But to understand, you must hear my story. The evening before, I had passed through Irafog, a small village of ex-slaves of the Tuareg. As usual when one reaches a village, the people ran out to crowd round the jeep. That evening, I had seen old Kada trembling with cold. It seems strange to speak of cold in the desert, but it is so. In fact, the Sahara is often called a cold country where it is very hot in the sun. The sun had gone down, and Kada was shivering. I had the idea of giving him one of the blankets I had with me, but I put the thought out of my mind. I thought of the night, and I knew that I too would shiver. The little charity that was in me made me think again, though reasoning that my skin wasn't worth more than his, and that I had best give him one of the blankets. Even if I shivered a little, that was the least a little brother could do. When I left the village, the blankets were still on the jeep, and now they were giving me a bad conscience. I tried to get to sleep with my feet resting on the great rock, but I couldn't manage it. I remembered that a month ago, a Tuareg in the middle of his siesta had been crushed by a falling slab. I got up to make sure how stable the boulder was. I saw that it was a little off balance, but not enough to be dangerous. I lay down again on the sand. I dreamed that I was asleep under the great boulder, and that at a given moment I saw the rock moving, and I felt the boulder fall on top of me. I felt my bones grating, and I found myself dead. No, alive, but with my body crushed under the stone. I was amazed that not a bone was hurt, but I couldn't move. I opened my eyes and saw Kada shivering in front of me at Irafog. I didn't hesitate for a minute to give him the blanket, especially as it was lying unused behind me, a yard away. I tried to stretch out my hand to offer it to him, but the stone made even the smallest movement impossible. I understood what purgatory was, and that the suffering of the soul was no longer to have the possibility of doing what before one could and should have done. Who knows for how many years afterwards I would be haunted by seeing that blanket near me as a witness to my selfishness and to the fact that I was too immature to enter the kingdom of love.
Though our image of John the Baptist is usually of a stern, forbidding figure, long-haired and wild-eyed, in his rough garb of camel hair, there must have been something appealing about him, whatever his appearance, to have drawn the multitude so powerfully. When the angel had foretold his birth to Zachary in the sanctuary of the temple, this is how the forerunner was described.
He will be your joy and delight, and many will rejoice at his birth, for he will be great in the sight of the Lord. He must drink no wine, no strong drink. Even from his mother's womb, he will be filled with the Holy Spirit, and he will bring back many of the sons of Israel to the Lord their God. With the spirit and power of Elijah, he will go before him to turn the hearts of fathers towards their children, and the disobedient back to the wisdom that the virtuous have, preparing for the Lord a people fit for him.
Jesus himself, when John was in prison, spoke to the people about him, declaring, "Of all the children born of women, there is no one greater than John." And Luke continues, "All the people who heard him, and the tax collectors too, acknowledged God's plan by accepting baptism from John." Tax collectors, soldiers, ordinary people. To these, John preached a message they could understand, a way of life that was within their reach, precepts that were not new, of elementary goodness, honesty, social justice, nothing extraordinary. John himself had lived the life of a hermit, an ascetic, eating frugally, drinking no strong drink. But there were those who did not accept him, the Pharisees and Sadducees, the priestly caste, the brood of vipers, as he called them. And of these same men, Jesus was speaking when he referred to the men of this generation, his contemporaries, who did not accept him either.
John the Baptist comes, not eating bread, not drinking wine, and you say, he is possessed. The Son of Man comes, eating and drinking, and you say, look, a glutton and a drunkard, a friend of tax collectors and sinners.
It's interesting that Luke, alone of the evangelists, has chosen to pick out two categories of the most hated people. Firstly, the tax collectors. Comments one scholar.
The tax collectors were regarded as public sinners, for as they collected taxes in the name of the oppressor, they were his collaborators, and also because they themselves were often hard to the point of injustice.
And yet here they are, queuing up with the rest for baptism by John. And he doesn't condemn them or turn them away, but only tells them what they know already, to exact nothing more than the fixed amount. Tax collectors appear often in the Gospels, and the conversion of two in particular, Matthew the evangelist and little Zacchaeus. Our Lord recounts the parable of the Pharisee and the publican, who is a tax collector, not a man who runs a public house. This meaning didn't come into use until the 18th century. And today's tax collectors have St. Matthew as their patron. Soldiers have as theirs St. Martin of Tours, who didn't have two cloaks, but cut the one he had into two pieces, offering half to a beggar shivering with cold. And that night he saw Jesus in a vision, wearing the half of his cloak that he'd given to the beggar, and saying, "Martin, yet a catechumen, has covered me with this garment." Martin, as the son of a veteran soldier, had been forced into the army at the age of 15. But for some years, writes Butler, though not yet formally a Christian, lived more like a monk than a soldier. After the vision, we're told, he flew to be baptized. Around the age of 20, he asked the Emperor Julian to let him now serve Christ, whose soldier he was. Julian accused him of cowardice, at which Martin retorted that he was prepared to stand in the battle line unarmed and to advance alone against the enemy in the name of Christ. He was thrown instead into prison, but when an armistice was concluded, he was finally discharged. Martin went to Poitiers, where St. Hilary, who was bishop there, received the young conscientious objector as a disciple. When Martin himself was bishop of Tours, he remarked on seeing a sheep which had just been shorn,
"It has fulfilled the gospel precept. It had two tunics and has given one to him who had none, and that is what you must do."
Martin himself had fulfilled the gospel precept many years before. The soldiers who came to John the Baptist are not identified as Jews or Gentiles. The latter, being probably Roman soldiers, would certainly not have been popular. An occupying army is never loved, and events of our own time have confirmed this. But if they were Jews, they would still have been hated and despised, for they would have been under Roman authority. The public's attitude towards soldiers is a fickle one, as this amusing 17th century epigram by Francis Quarles records.
Our God and soldiers, we alike adore, even at the brink of danger, not before. After deliverance, both alike requited, our God's forgotten, and our soldiers slighted.
As the crowds come and go, John becomes aware of the feeling of anticipation, of expectancy. The people are wondering in their hearts, we read. But surely also, as they meet each other on the banks of the Jordan, voicing their feelings to each other. What do you think? This prophet, could he possibly be... Would they have dared to say the word Messiah aloud? Perhaps not. But John anticipates any questions, setting the record straight with a declaration that left no room for doubts. There is one to come who is mightier than I. We can almost hear the murmured, Oh, rising from the crowd, who would have moved closer to hear more. And John then presses the comparison further by the statement that he is not fit to loosen his sandal strap. Murmurs of surprise. It was considered a very lowly task to unloose another's sandals. And now John warms to his subject, and the voice of the man of God, the forerunner, the last prophet of the Old Testament, rings out in a series of vivid images his listeners would have recognized. Every peasant in Palestine knew what a winnowing fan was. It was used at threshing time to separate the wheat from the chaff, usually in the early hours of the evening when the sea breeze began to blow after a hot day. The act of winnowing consisted in exposing the grain to the wind or to a current of air, so that the lighter particles, the chaff or husks, were separated from the seeds and blown away. In modern farming, the combine harvester carries out what were once several different operations. A field guide of today explains what took place during threshing in the past.
The sheaves were pitchforked down onto the hard-surfaced threshing floor in the centre of the barn, between the facing pairs of doors at each side. Here they were bashed with flails, which were simply strips of wood nailed to leather belts. This process separated the grain from the chaff. Then the mix was winnowed, that is, the doors of the barn were opened wide on both sides to let the breeze through, while the threshed grain was tossed into the air, allowing the light chaff to be blown away. The grain was then swept up and taken to be stored in the granary.
One element present in our gospel is missing in this description, the fire in which the chaff is to be burned, unquenchable fire. Somehow one feels that when John spoke these words, there would have been a moment of discomfort among the crowd, and perhaps a certain melting away, rather as happened on the occasion of the woman taken in adultery. The barn door is open and ready to winnow, reads the first line of a poem by John Clare. Are we ready, then, for the winnowing?
And you were listening there to Jill Bevilacqua. She'll be back again with the next in her series, There's More in the Sunday Gospel Than Meets the Eye, at this same time next week. Meanwhile, why don't we join Joan Lewis, EWTN's Bureau Chief here in Rome, as she brings us the Vatican Week in review. So, Joan, welcome back.
What a fun week this has been. I mean, marked by papal tweets.
One of my former colleagues said when Pope tweeted, she said they should have said, watch the birdie.
Yes, exactly. Well, it was all flashed on the big screen in the Paul VI hall anyway.
But it made big news, didn't it?
Oh, it really did. I mean, you look at all the agencies. If you just did papal tweet, Pope, Twitter, something else like that on a Google search, you would have come up with a huge number of articles in many languages. But this came at the end of the Wednesday audience. We'll look back, obviously, at the other news of the week, too. But this came at the end of the Wednesday audience and the fact the Pope would be formally on Twitter with his own handle.
And in various languages.
And in various languages. And the new one also is at Pontifex. And then you have underscore ES for Spanish, underscore FR for French, and so forth. So there are a total of 8 languages. The biggest one is simply at Pontifex, and that's the English. I mean, that already has 1.1 million followers. And the total in all the languages is close to 2 million at this point. So, I mean, days, you know, after the Pope sent his first tweet. And this was all done in view of the public. The table was brought in front of the Pope after he finished his catechesis on the year of faith, a table and a tablet. What was very interesting is that the tweet said, "Dear friends, I'm pleased to get in touch with you through Twitter. Thank you for your generous support. I bless all of you from my heart, Benedict the 16th." And it is interesting because there was huge support just right after the December 3rd announcement in the press office of the Pope's handle and how often he would tweet. He did tweet 3 times in the remainder of the day. So there was this initial one, which he did right there, as I say, about 11:30 in the morning at the end of the audience.
Which he'll repeat on
and
Wednesdays.
It seems that it's going to be on Wednesdays that he will have a message, but that doesn't exclude or preclude the fact that on a Sunday after an Angelus or another big feast day, there could be a tweet. But what is very interesting is that what he did in the 3 tweets spaced at the interval of several hours on that Wednesday, 12/12/12, the date, a similar date, a month, day, and a year being the same, which won't happen for another 88 years, something else like that. Anyway, at the end of the day, then, the Pope, or during the day, the Pope answered 3 questions that were sent to him from 3 different continents. The first one, how can we celebrate the year of faith better in our daily lives? And he said, and this is so amazing because this is 140 characters. He said, by speaking with Jesus in prayer, listening to what he tells you in the gospel, and looking for him in those who need. I mean, that is totally brilliant. And second question, how can faith in Jesus be lived in a world without hope? Answer, we can be certain that a believer is never alone. God is the solid rock upon which we build our lives, and his love is always faithful.
So we can look forward to more tweets.
Yes, we can. And what they said at the press conference was that if the Pope does not write the 140-character message himself, he will see and approve it. So nothing will go out in any language. They'll all be the same, of course, any tweets. Nothing will go out without his approval. So kind of a fun day. And, you know, the Church has to be and has been. As soon as there's some development in the new media, the Church is there because the Social Communications Council works very, very hard at that, has a very good staff who's really terrific with all this technology. So, in fact, it was one of them who actually was there with 2 kind of interns.
You know, I think it's worth saying this because he was one of our former colleagues here at the radio many
TJ
years ago.
Thaddeus Jones.
Yeah. Jones, yes.
Yeah. Exactly. No, in fact, I put his name on my blog. I mean, he's a friend. A lot of people know him and have heard his voice in the past. So that tremendous honor of helping the Holy Father was his. And there were also, as I said, 2 interns from Villanova University working as interns at the council and a Mexican journalist. And the presence, just to point this out, too, the presence of both English and Spanish media people, that was to mark the Congress that had concluded that day, Ecclesia in America. And of course, the participants in that Congress, 3-day Congress that actually began with a Mass. So we're going to be talking about that because that's important. It began with a Mass on Sunday, and the Holy Father spoke to the participants at the end of Mass. He was not the main presider. But so you have the 2 languages, the Ecclesia in America and the Church in America, not the Americas, but you do have North and South America and predominantly English and Spanish language. So,
Ecclesia in America,
a big day.
Yeah, Ecclesia in America, of course, was one of the spotlights of this week, wasn't it?
Well, it was, and as I said, it was a 3-day conference, began on the 9th, ended on the 12th. I guess if you include the 9th, that's really 4 days, 9, 10, 11, 12. The Holy Father arrived at the Basilica after the Mass on Sunday at 7 o'clock and spoke to the participants, and he said what any Vatican official what any bishop in his diocese has been saying about the not only the Year of Faith, but certainly the new evangelization. Jesus is at the center of everything. And it's getting to know Jesus, living who he is, what he has taught us to be as Christians. That should be at the center of our lives, and that's how we're going to evangelize. And the Holy Father recognized that this can be difficult because as the original apostolic exhortation following the 1997 Synod on the Church in America, the apostolic exhortation by the same name focused then, as we must now, on the challenges and difficulties that present specific and complex characteristics. The Holy Father spoke about secularism, various religious groups spreading throughout the continent, giving rise to numerous problems. He spoke of the widespread mentality that tends to attack the dignity of the person, damaging also institutions of marriage and family. He highlighted the painful situations of emigration, displacement of people, or violence, especially when linked to organized crime, drug trafficking, corruption, arms dealing. And he also highlighted in his talk what Cardinal Ouellet did, who is prefect of the Congregation for Bishops and also head of, within that congregation, head of the Commission for Latin America. What was a central part of the Congress itself, of the Pope's speech, of Cardinal Ouellet's remarks, was the fact that the churches in North and South America, Central America, have to work closer together to be even more unified in their message to have this new evangelization work.
Joan, then the Pope received the non-resident ambassadors to the Holy See on Thursday, and they presented their credentials.
Exactly. That's a very interesting thing because our listeners know there are ambassadors from different countries accredited to the Holy See. When they do not live in Rome because they might also be an ambassador someplace else, that's when the Holy Father would receive them as a group. He receives the letters of credence from each ambassador. He gives his own message to each ambassador about them, about their country that they represent. But then he gives a speech aimed at all six of them, problems that he knows might be common to their countries. And the new countries, the new ambassadors were from Zambia, Thailand, Sri Lanka, St. Vincent and the Grenadines, Niger, and Guinea. And so basically the Holy Father, without going into a lot of detail, he did concentrate his address to all of them on education and saying, you know, social networks today seem to have taken over everything. The family doesn't seem to be there as a prime mover in educating. Schools don't seem to be there or seem to be dysfunctional in many, many ways. And he said, isn't it the dysfunction of certain institutions and services, public and private? Might this not be explained because the people who are with these associations have had an inadequately provided education? So lots of great remarks on education, and I'm sure the ambassadors will bring those remarks back to their country, as well as the specific message, which the Vatican does make public, given to each ambassador. As we close the show, we can look forward to the
To Christmas.
Well, the lighting of the Christmas tree occurred Thursday afternoon.
In St. Peter's Square.
In St. Peter's Square. The nativity scene will be unveiled on the 24th. It's from the Basilicata region, presented by officials from that region at a press conference this week, but only unveiled on the 24th. And then the nativity scene in St. Peter's Square is usually up until the Feast of the Presentation on February 2nd. And that's usually how long I leave my home Christmas decorations up, too. So that's when the season kind of officially ends for the Vatican and they take the crib down. So I'll see you next week with more Christmas news.
Well, thank you very much, Joan. And you were listening there to Joan Lewis, EWTN's Bureau Chief here in Rome. And that brings me up to time. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Thanks so much for listening. Don't forget, we won't be back again at this same time tomorrow, but we will be back again at this same time next weekend. You've been listening to the English programme of Vatican Radio. Laudetur Jesus Christus.